Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And I have with me today my very good friend, Michael Prantley, also a PHA member, longtime professional handler, and an AKC Breeder of the Year for the non-sporting group in 2005.
That's a good question. No, it was 15 or so.
I think it was. It was not too long ago. For his Dreamland Chow Chows. So we've talked before on this show about breeders and professional handlers not being mutually exclusive. And I think Michael is one of the best people we can talk to on that topic. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
I appreciate it. So give us the 411, we call it. The how, who, when, why, where. How'd you get involved in dogs?
Well, my parents were breeding Pekingese before I was born, and they were showing. And when I was about 5 years old, they got a chow and just fell in love with the breed. So I helped my parents show their dogs as a kid and showed in juniors a little bit and just became a passion. Still, the breeding is very important to me, probably more so than the handling. The handling is more the game, but the breeding is the art.
Absolutely. We've seen that meme, and I think it is so dead on.
Yeah, it really is. That was on the mark.
Absolutely. But, and you have something like 200 champions.
I've never counted. I really have never counted, but it's over 200,
Wow. And that's since, what, mid-80s?
Since the 70s, I kind of took over from my parents in the late 70s,
So you went from showing your family's dogs into then where did the professional handling come in?
A friend came up and asked me to see if I could take their chow out to finish his championship. So I took this dog and I finished it and they gave me money. And it was awesome. I said, I can support my habit doing this. So started out part-time, developed over the years. I'd show a few dogs here and there until the point to where I quit my regular job and handled full-time. I've been handling full-time for 40-something years.
Long as I've been in the game.
It ended up from a hobby to a career.
Well, and I think for so many of us, that's not dissimilar from my life path, particularly. And you are a member of the Professional Handlers Association.
I am.
So we're going to take a little segue here, and people ask me all the time, how do I select a professional handler? And you know, I had an interview, we talked to Dinah Bagenstos, who's president of PHA. Mm-hmm. And you have PHA, you have the AKC Registered Handler Program. Talk to us a little bit, for our listeners, if you decide that you're going to hire a professional handler, how do you do that?
Well, the starting point is to find somebody that's involved with one of those organizations because they've had to meet the requirements of vehicles, of equipment. They've had people keep an eye on them for a few years to make sure that they are responsible with other people's dogs. From there, I suggest just watching those handlers work, watching how they take care of their dogs, how they treat their dogs. You don't want somebody just to go out and win with your dog. You want somebody that's going to love them like you do. So that's my suggestion, is pay attention.
And it seems like we shouldn't have to make this point, but we do love them like you do.
We do.
When was the last time you cried the last time I sent a dog home?
Some of the dogs that we specialed through the years, we'd have for 2 or 3 years, they became our dogs. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to send them home. It's hard, hard,
I just
hard.
Sent one home, and it was ugly crying.
But now that I'm a grandfather in real life, it's a little more like spoiling the grandkids and then sending them home to the mom. Let them deal with all the problems we created.
Excellent. We spoil them worse than you do.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, so from the breeding perspective, talk to us a little bit about your mentors. Who mentored you? Who guided you outside of your folks, both in the handling and in the breeding?
Well, in the breeding aspect of it, we had an old-time chow person in Lubbock, Texas, named Hal Allen, who I grew up in his backyard watching him raise puppies, and he was one of the founding members of the chow club and did a whole lot for the breed. So I had a very good start learning from him. There's been a lot of people I've looked up to in my breed through the years. Most of them are gone now. But Hal gave me that start. He would let me sit in the whelping box and watch these puppies play and see which one we thought was going to be the big show winner. And that was a great thing to do. We also had a bulldogger that I spent a lot of time with who had some of the top winning dogs in the history of the breed. So it wasn't just the chows. And that's something I really want to impress, is that I think the handling of the other breeds has really helped me understand my breed better. Helped me understand structure and function tremendously more than if I had just stuck with my breed and not sit around and watch these other dogs show or learn the standards of them before I showed the dogs. So it's been a double-edged thing there, to where it's taught me a lot.
And I completely agree with you. And I think it's something that we can offer to new exhibitors.
Yeah.
You don't have to go be a professional handler.
No.
There is nothing stopping you from going and learning about other breeds and
Absolutely.
Sit and watch them and sit and watch them be judged and read their standard. And
when I was a kid, Hal Allen, we would sit there and we would watch the breeds, we'd watch the groups, we'd watch Best in Show. We'd be there all day. Mm-hmm. And that taught me a lot. Taught me to pay attention.
And I think that, I don't know how to say it any other way than, listeners, pay attention. This is probably the 180th time you've heard this. This is how you learn.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so far as people when handling, I would find the breeders that were the most successful in each of those breeds. If I was going to take on a dog of a new breed, I would go to those people and I would look at their dogs. I would see how they groom them, see what they were looking for. You learn from the experts. And rather than just going out on your own and saying, I can show this dog just like I show every other dog, each breed is different. There were a couple of professional handlers that's old-time people that I learned from. Roy Murray down our way was a big influence. Kenny Rensick, probably the biggest influence in my life. He's one of the smartest people I ever knew and wisest. I mean, he had a lot of experience. Yeah. He had shown a chow to the top spot several times. So he was kind of my mentor in pushing me to the next level in my breed.
Absolutely. So we have a lot of young people in our sport that we want to encourage. And we want to encourage them to stay involved. If they want to stay involved as a professional handler, we want to encourage them to do it in a good way. So what would your recommendations be on that?
Well, my recommendation is that you don't just treat this as being a professional handler. You're also somebody who can give advice to the breeders that you're working for. We would show generations of dogs for people in other breeds. And we were part of their breeding program.
Yes.
We were the sounding board. We would talk back and forth to say, okay, I think you need to bring this dog to this bitch and vice versa, because I think this could help. You're a big part of their breeding programs, and you should be, and you should have the knowledge to provide to those people. They may be the expert in that breed, but you are a dog person. You should know which dogs structurally are correct, which ones can do their job, and so on and so forth in that respect. But to me, you have to be involved in the breeding to be a good handler. It goes hand in hand, and whether you breed yourself or you give advice to other breeders, either way, you have to be involved in that if you want to be successful at this.
And I think that's just such a really, really good point, Michael, that there is synergy between the two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we learn from one to give to the other and vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think that too often, some of the people who are learning now haven't learned all of the components.
Yeah, I think there is. There's not as
and
many
so
kids.
And so how do we help them learn those components?
The apprenticing is the big thing. If you're not in there with somebody that's well-respected, either in their breed or as a handler, and learning from those people, then going out and learning it on your own is hard.
Takes a long time.
Takes a long time. Take advantage of the people with the knowledge and work for them for a year or whatever.
More.
Or more. But that's how you learn. It's not something you can just read a book and go out and do. You have to be in the trenches. Know what makes those dogs tick. Learn animal behavior.
Safety.
Safety, absolutely. And know what works and what doesn't work. It's a hands-on thing.
And I think it is hands-on with supervision. That's the idea of the apprenticeship.
That's exactly it.
You
yeah.
know, that,
yeah.
that way you are learning.
Yeah.
I've always loved the apprenticeship concept, you know, from when it was ancient concept of this is how you learned how to be a tailor or a shoemaker or what have you.
This
is you learn hands-on work by doing hands-on work with supervision.
Right. It's a physical business. It's something that you do with your hands. It's an art, yeah, and your legs and your hips and everything else. It's an art form.
Yes.
It truly is. And to master that craft, you really have to spend the time to learn from somebody who has mastered it.
Learn from a master craftsman.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So then taking the swing that 90 degrees to the breeding and talking to our breeder listeners, or people who maybe are just getting their first dog and they just want to learn how to show their dog. You know, they don't have any great aspiration. They just want to show their dog. What is some of your best advice for them?
My best advice is learn your breed. Whatever breed you decide upon, learn it, study it, understand what makes it that breed before you ever walk in the ring. You can walk in with a bulldog and try to show it like a sporting dog, and you're not going to win.
Not going to win.
You have to understand that breed and make sure that's the breed for you. Make sure that it fits your lifestyle, that you can deal with the idiosyncrasies of that breed. Make sure it's a fit. But watch the handlers. Watch the people that are successful competing in that breed. Watch the people that are successful breeding. I got my dog from one breeder, this is how it is, and that's it. No, you go learn from everybody. Whether you like their style of dog or not, learn from them. Look and see why those people are going out and winning with their dogs. The show ring is just a mirror of our whelping box. We go out there and compete with our dogs to prove what we think we saw in the whelping box.
I think that's beautiful, a mirror of the whelping box. That's a wonderful line. So in brief, and I know this is hard to be in brief, when we're talking about Chow Chows and a successful breeding program, talk to us about Chow Chows. Talk to us about how you make, in your breeding program, really good dogs. What do your pedigrees look like? Are you breeding? Do you have a specific breeding plan? That kind of a thing.
We do to an extent. I mean, we breed pedigrees. Our pedigrees are very important because that tells us what we may get in that litter. Now, that's not a certainty. We're dealing with a lot of genes. But it's more than that. You can't take two dogs with beautiful pedigrees and breed them together, and if they were ugly, you're probably going to get some ugly puppies. You have to know what the strong points are of each dog. You have to know what the downsides are to where you can have dogs that complement each other when you're breeding. We breed very closely.
Yeah.
I mean, we line breed and maybe to the point of inbreeding at times.
Okay.
But we do that with health in mind. We test everybody to make sure that we're keeping our dogs healthy.
And temperament.
And temperament is very, very important. And temperament is genetic.
It
is. As far as I'm concerned, especially in my breed,
Absolutely. It
is very genetic. We can look down a line of dogs and we see all these traits that come down from grandmother, grandfather, great-grandfather. I mean, it just keeps coming down. That's a big thing when you're breeding. You can have the most beautiful dog in the world out there, and if the temperament's wrong and it won't go out and be in public, then what good is it? It's not even a good companion for a family. And as a breeder, that's the other thing we really look for. Maybe 20-25% of the dogs that we breed will end up in the show ring. Maybe. So the rest of those dogs are going to go as companions to people. And a breed that's very strong-willed, very independent, like Chows are, and like our Tibetan Mastiffs are as well, it's extremely important to have the proper temperament to where they end up as being great pets for somebody. And that's the other thing we fight is with all the anti-dog legislation, and they say go get a dog from the shelter or whatever. Well, we need to prove them wrong. We need to prove that the breeders are doing the work. We're spending the money to do all the testing. We're working with them. We're dealing with the temperaments and developing better dogs than what they would get going to a shelter and picking up a dog.
And this just kind of came into my mind as we were talking. I mean, you're talking about Tibetan Mastiffs and Chows. You're talking about two breeds that are not known to be golden retrievers in temperament.
Yeah.
Okay, we know what these dogs are. So do you have success educating your puppy buyers? So it's not just making a sound-minded dog. You have to educate who's buying the dog.
You do have to educate them. My wife, Linda, is extremely good at screening people. She has an extensive application. She talks to these folks for months ahead of time. If she gets any inkling that maybe these people just don't have the temperament to deal with these breeds, then she's going to say, I don't think this is the breed for you. But we've been able to train and teach a lot of folks that we didn't think we would.
You're talking about breeds with a lot of hair. They require a lot of grooming. They require training. Yeah. You can't just throw a chow in the backyard and pat it on the head. This isn't going to work.
And the grooming's the easy part. I mean, all the Asian breeds are very similar. The TMs, the Chows, the Shar Pei, the Akita, they're all very similar. They're smart.
Yes.
They're strong-willed. They think for themselves. They're happier there, but they would rather go out and hang out by themselves. So you've got to learn how to deal with that. And it's not something you learn overnight, and it's something that you've got to figure out that, yeah, I got to be tougher than my dog is.
I have to actually be the leader.
I have to be the alpha in this pack.
Well, the leader. I say with the Akitas, I always say they need to trust me and respect.
They need to respect you. Yes, it has to be a respect thing, and that's you being the pack leader.
But they don't trust without respect either. Those two things have to be there at the same time.
And that's the one thing I've learned with our Tibetan Mastiffs. Is I have shown a lot of other people's Tibetan Mastiffs and finished them and done okay with them. But with that breed, in order to really do well, it has to be a dog I've raised. They're so independent and so bonded to their people that it's very, very difficult to take a dog from somebody else and try to do as you would as a professional handler with other breeds.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
We're here at the Tibetan Mastiff National, so I wish you great good fortune.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking to a few more people today, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy with her tip of the week, which we always love. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Other than the zombies, I'm pretty good.
Good to hear.
So what are we talking about today?
Well, today I thought we would talk about bitches in season at a dog show and a couple different tricks I use to manage a boy dog that won't let that idea go.
Mm-hmm. That's a great one.
I was hoping you'd think so.
I think that's a great one. So what happens when you have that naughty, sort of pimply 15-year-old boy in a dog suit?
So first of all, I mean, bitches, that's going to happen. They're going to come in season. You know, we are there to adjudicate breeding stock. So these things have to happen. So clearly, you're going to, especially this time of year, you're going to have your eye out for it. And, you know, you're going to keep your dog away from bitches you might suspect that are in season. Hopefully, exhibitors of bitches who are in season are courteous enough to warn you of that if you're showing a male. So I have kind of two things I do to distract them. So one is the tried and true Vicks Vapo Rub in my tack box.
Yep.
And, you know, the idea is that you rub a little bit under their nose and then they can't really smell the bitch in season or they don't smell her as strongly, so they're not as excited about it. My other trick is I also use vanilla, like liquid vanilla that you would use for baking.
Yep, that's what I use.
Yeah, I find that sometimes they get a little bit used to the Vicks.
Right.
So if you switch over to the vanilla or you kind of use two of them back and forth, it kind of helps you out, right?
Yep.
So those are my two distraction methods. So I had recently campaigned a Kerry Blue Terrier who, when there was a girl in season, he was gone. No, it didn't matter what bait I used. It didn't matter what I did, how I stood on my head. If he had an idea that a bitch was in season, there was no controlling him.
Unmanageable.
He was almost unmanageable. And so I went to my tried and true trick of get a squeaky toy, a fluffy squeaky toy, and use it only for this purpose and find a bitch in season and kind of wipe her nether regions with it rather lavishly.
Preferably with the owner's permission.
Yes, definitely with the owner's and the bitch's permission. And get it so that it smells like a bitch in season. And then I always use like a different kind or a different color squeaky toy.
Right.
I really don't want to be holding on to that if I don't have to be.
Right.
And when you're just, you've lost that dog, a lot of times I know with my Kerry, it did work like a charm. I could show him that squeaky toy and let him smell it. And then he just totally paid attention to that squeaky toy. Like
Absolutely.
That was his girlfriend. He was like, and it really made him actually come right up on his toes.
I bet it did.
It was phenomenal. He actually showed some of the best he ever showed. And then I also recommend that you keep that squeaky toy like in a Ziploc bag to really like kind of preserve that scent in there, because Not always is there going to be a female in season that's going to allow you near her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a good thing to have around. And also, like I said, you just don't want to be picking up that squeaky toy willy-nilly when you're not expecting it.
Right.
So I kind of keep chasing down.
I love that. I would do that with a squeaky toy and I would keep it in the freezer. Just like you would, you know, like if you're trying to collect a dog or something, you have your bitch rag, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, those are the things that you use to try to distract your dog on one hand, or, you know, if you just need that absolute peak performance, you know, I use the squeaky toy. And actually, a weekend ago, I had a new exhibitor, a student of mine, and she actually went reserve best in show with her Bouvier. And in the breed, there was a Bouvier in season, and she couldn't get it. Like, she was losing her mind, and she came over and asked me for help. And we used that trick, and she's like, oh my God, that worked so good. I thought you're like, da 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 da. And then she ended up going reserve best in show, which made me look really smart.
You look super smart.
Yeah, she did a great job with her dog, and you know, it was another leading success.
Well, there you go. So, the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy right there.
There you go.
And don't forget to put your Pure Dog Talk 25 for a 25% discount off your courses, and that will save you a few bucks by a cup of coffee on us.
That sounds like a great idea.
Awesome. Thank you, Allison.
No problem at all, Laura.
Welcome, Pure Dog Talk listeners, to Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. She's here with her tip of the week for us today. And I think This is one I'm going to agree real strongly with Allison. So thanks, Allison. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Laura.
Excellent. So talk to me about when you're in the ring and you're nervous and you just keep brushing your dog.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess for me, you know, I was brought up with Afghan hounds and miniature poodles, you know, that lots of brushing, lots of grooming. But the first book I ever read on junior showmanship by Marsha Hall Brown, she just talked about like that if you absolutely had to correct some grooming in the ring, you could only do it out of sight of the judge. And preferably that would be, you know, she talked about the golden rule in junior handling where you never get between your dog and the judge. But she said, if you ever had to groom your dog in the ring, you would only do it with your back to the judge, blocking the view of, so the judge could not see you actually grooming the dog. So I'm not really sure why that stuck with me so much, because I do show a lot of coat heavy, grooming heavy breeds, but that has stuck with me for a very long time. And then early in my professional handling career, it was again, it was reinforced by a judge. And this is what happened. We were in the non-sporting group, and in Canada, Shih Tzus are in the non-sporting group. And for whatever reason, the Shih Tzu was, I can't remember what I was showing, but the Shih Tzu was on the table in front of me. So I watched the judge examine the dog and then ask it to, you know, move down and back. And before the dog was moved down and back, the handler basically brushed it out. Like, they fixed the top knot, they combed the beard, they, like, fix the tail, they brush it on both sides, and they brush it on both sides again, and they tweak the top knot again. And it was a big production that I most likely would not have noticed, except that even before that Shih Tzu went around to the end of the line and I was waiting to be the next one to go down and back, the judge said to me, you know, do they think that I have all the time in the world that they can just totally re-groom their dog while I'm waiting? She said, that is so rude, and I'm so glad that you never do it. Well, I mean, luck was on my side that I didn't do it, but it just really stuck with me that, yes, if you're grooming your dog in front of the judge, you are taking up the judge's precious time, right? And, you know, especially these judges are judging 175 dogs in a day, and you're the 170th, they're tired now, right? Especially if it's day three, day four on a circuit. And, you know, I have this course at Leading Edge Dog Show Academy called The Best Dog in 2 Minutes, where I explain my theory about dog shows, about how I think dog shows are about the dog that looks the best in those 2 minutes. You know, we have a lifetime to decide how good or bad that dog is, but a judge has 2 minutes. And really, when it comes to undistracted time focusing on your dog, it's probably closer to 40 seconds, right? So if you have 40 seconds of the judge's undivided time and you're wasting 20 or 30 seconds grooming your dog, I don't think that bodes really well for you. So I guess my point is, yes, there are times when you are going to have to fix a top knot or a beard, or, you know, your dog runs around the ring and it gets a bit of slobber in it, or it kicks a leaf in it, or, you know, a piece of bait flies from another ring into your dog, or, you know, simply their hair just went askew for whatever reason. It was super windy. But I'm saying that you really need to keep the grooming to a minimum. Whenever possible, you're going to have your back to the judge when you do it. And especially if the judge has just examined your dog and is waiting for you to do the individual gating pattern, I think that that is probably the worst time to adjust the hair on your dog.
Absolutely. And I find myself, because of course I'm like you, old school, I don't want to touch them if the judge is looking. And so when I find myself in the worst position is when I'm showing a drop-coated breed with a part. And you get them off the table, right? You get them off the table, you get them out of the stack. And what do? Promptly shake it all out. Of course they do.
Right.
And so then I'm torn. I'm like, okay, I got to fix this. No, I can't. You know, so yeah, give us a hand on
it. Yeah. And I mean, I do understand that. You know, I have lots of friends that show really beautiful Shih Tzus, and they have asked me to show their winner's dog for them for the breed. And I'm always happy to help. But they probably haven't asked me in about 10 years because I have that knack of I put the drop coated breed on the floor and it shakes and then you can no longer even see its bow. Yes. Like I have no idea. They can show it. They can win the class. They can go winner's dog. It doesn't shake. You can always see the bow. Allison shows it for 30 seconds. It no longer has a bow.
Yes.
So I do understand that there are times when it's absolutely necessary. But when in front of the judge, just really keep it to a minimum.
Yep, absolutely agree. Even when my TT has completely blown that perfect part. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Allison. We always appreciate your time. And listeners, please don't forget, cup of coffee on us when you do Pure Dog Talk 25 as your checkout code on your Leading Edge Dog Show Academy course. Save 25%.
We love that.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.